Hello, this is Monica Reeds and I'm Georgina Godwin. This is the last in a series of programmes looking ahead to Hay Festival, one of the biggest and best literary events in the world. It's taken place annually since 1987, and this year it's online from the 26th of May to the 6th of June, broadcasting the world's greatest writers and thinkers for free from Hay-on-Wye, the small town on the border of Wales. And Monica Reeds and Meet the Writers will be there, bringing you highlights from the festival and interviews with the participants. Well, in today's episode, we want to examine the strand looking at the impact of the pandemic and ask writers and thinkers for their thoughts on our post-COVID future. One particular aspect that will be discussed is gender equality in the time of COVID-19. Now, I'm joined by Everyday Sexism founder Laura Bates, who leads a series of discussions around motherhood and the ways COVID-19 has impacted upon that. Laura, thanks so much for joining us. Now, you've been involved in Hay for a long time. How do you feel about the digital festival opening up the event globally, reaching people who otherwise might not get to enjoy events and join important discussions?
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be talking to you again. I think it's a wonderful thing. While, of course, like everybody else, I was absolutely heartbroken at the loss of the physical festival and the wonderful, almost indescribable atmosphere of readers and thinkers and writers coming together, there was a wonderful opening of new possibilities and horizons, actually, and the realization that that same spirit of communing and of discussion and investigation and mutual curiosity and exploration and new ideas sparking, that all of that could actually happen on an international stage virtually. And while, of course, we mustn't make the assumption that that virtual space is accessible to everybody, nonetheless, there was a massively increased accessibility about it. And for me, it came so vibrantly clearly to life when I was lucky enough to do a kind of event as part of that festival with Gloria Steinem, and suddenly realized that I think almost 10,000 people around the world were there listening with us, joining us in that conversation, interacting, taking part, asking her questions and sending in their thoughts and sharing on social media. And that was just completely incredible. So I think something really beautiful and positive has come out of it as well.
Yes. I wonder how you chose the women in your gender equality in the time of COVID-19 strand, and what vital things are they going to be talking about?
Gosh, well, I think it was obviously a very difficult thing to try and narrow down because there are so many people talking about so many important issues at the moment. And I know that many of those will also be covered elsewhere in the festival. But I think each of the women on the panel will bring something different and has been speaking about different issues that have come out. It's very easy to sort of talk about gender in the time of COVID as if it's one topic, but actually it's so many. And you've got Catelyn Moran, who has been speaking about the kind of burden carried by middle-aged women in particular in kind of keeping the world turning, very much a message from pre-COVID, but of course something that we really saw, that under-acknowledged, underfunded, invisible burden of unpaid care work that's being done by middle-aged women, looking after both children and often elderly relatives and vulnerable people as well, that just completely exploded during COVID. I mean, the impact on women, as we know, was massive. Working mums were only able to do 1 hour of uninterrupted work for every 3 hours that was done by working dads. They were massively more likely to lose their jobs or take voluntary redundancy. There was a report by Citibank that found that of the 44 million expected redundancies worldwide, 31 million of them would be women. And a huge part of that was just the assumption that women would add to their already massive spinning plates, homeschooling, suddenly becoming an educator on top of everything else and taking on a huge amount of the kind of domestic burden as well. So there were obviously kind of massive areas there that were very relevant. Jolie Brealey, who has written a book about the Pregnant Then Screwed, which is the charity that she founded, but also the issue that she champions, did huge amounts of work during the pandemic around the rights of particularly women who were in labour or going to hospital
hospital appointments, not being able to have birth partners, women who in some cases were going through miscarriages and labour alone, even while pubs were heaving, the rights of women to be protected at work in the early phases of the pandemic, particularly looking at women in low-paid public-facing roles, particularly aware of the intersectional impact of the pandemic when it came to race and ethnicity, as well as gender. So she will have so much to say, of course, that's really important as well. And then, of course, Pragya Agarwal, who's written Motherhood, which is all about the very different paths to motherhood, the kind of multiplicity of modern versions of motherhood, and the huge impact and strain on women of society's perception of what motherhood is, what it should be, how it should be policed, the kind of stereotypes that we're expected to fit into. And of course, all of that has never really been more relevant either, particularly as we face coming out of this crisis and reckoning with another, which is the possibility that will have sent us back decades when it comes to gender equality. So all of them, I think, will have so much to bring to the discussion, and very different, but also, of course, overlapping ideas and experiences.
Mm. Now, I know that also Margaret Reynolds, Nell Frizzell and Donna Freitas are talking to Emma Gannon about how our ideas of motherhood are changing. I had a really interesting discussion with Emma Freud today, and we were talking about how marriages used to be about the mother and the father being together, and then the children left home and the father or the husband was still the kind of sort of primary person in the woman's life. And it seemed to both of us that that has changed in a way now, where husbands or partners come and go. It's the children that are now the ones that are there always.
Yeah, I think that's a really such an interesting way of reframing the way in which we look at and kind of approach these conversations. I think it's going to be a really fantastic panel, that one as well. Really interesting, especially because Emma, of course, herself, who is chairing it, has written a brilliant book, Olive, kind of exploring that sort of assumption that motherhood and kind of heteronormative domestic partnership and children are the sort of automatic pinnacle of aspiration for women in their late 20s. And I think that it will be really interesting to see that kind of re-examined from a very different angle. And again, by such an incredible panel with so many different things to say about it.
I wonder how all this aligns with your everyday sexism movement and the Me Too movement, both having renewed momentum over the last few months.
Well, of course, as ever, these things are all very closely connected. You know, society likes to put these issues in different boxes and act as if they're completely separate and unrelated issues with unrelated solutions. But the reality, of course, is that in every one of these cases, what we're talking about really is about power, about where the power is, about who is making the decisions that affect us as a society, about which problems are considered valid and worthy for society to try and address and for government to address, and at what point those problems are seen as urgent enough to require action. You know, if you talk about something like the recent resurgence in attention to violence against women, it's interesting to ask questions about which cases hit the headlines and why, at what point governments suddenly wake up and decide that they need to be seen to be doing something to tackle a problem, which in fact they have absolutely unequivocally known about for decades. And of course, the same is true when we look at something like the unequal impact of the pandemic on certain groups of people, and you trace it back to who was in the room where decisions were being made about that, you know, and did any of them have lived experience that was relevant to the lives of people in particular communities that were being worst affected in terms of death rates, people in communities who were being affected in terms of redundancies? And very often the answer is no, they didn't. So they might seem like quite different topics, but in fact, really, if you look at the big picture, we are very much still talking about the same issues at their root.
Now, you have written a novel. It's your debut novel. It's a YA book, a young adult book called The Burning. But it's very much rooted in all of these ideas that you're talking about. It has a dual timeline. We're looking at a contemporary 15-year-old Anna. She is bullied after a topless photograph of her circulates at her school. We're also looking at Maggie, who's accused of witchcraft hundreds of years before. Tell us how you then take that into your exploration of sexism in schools and the history of misogyny.
Well, it very much grew out of my experiences of working with young people in schools around these kinds of issues, which is something that I've been doing for about 10 years. And just meeting thousands of young people and starting to recognise that the reality of what they are dealing with at school on a day-to-day basis really isn't as far removed as you might think from the extreme misogyny faced by women centuries before. And I think for many people listening, that might sound like an exaggeration, that might sound absurd, but the reality is that we have this hard statistics and facts to back this up. We know from an End Violence Against Women Coalition poll through YouGov, for example, that almost one in three 16 to 18 year old girls experiences unwanted sexual touching at school. In other words, we're living in a world, in a country, where a third of girls are being sexually assaulted on school premises. We have freedom of information requests from police forces, which have shown that, and this was an FOI submitted by the BBC, which have shown that in a 3-year period, there were 5,500 sexual offences, including 600 rapes reported to UK police as having occurred within schools. And if you do the maths of the average length of the school term, we're talking about one rape per school day being reported as happening inside a UK school. So you might think, well, how ridiculous to compare the situation of today's girls in a much more equal society to the kind of mob rule, mob justice, misogynistic witch hunts of 400 years ago. But the reality is that in many cases, some of the underlying ideas and power imbalances are actually horrifyingly, chillingly similar. And that was what made me want to write the book, really, to explore how little things have changed, to explore the lack of awareness that many adults and parents have about what's really going on for young women in their lives, particularly online and in the kind of witch hunts of the online world. And I suppose to give a voice to the hundreds of young women I meet and work with who are going through these incredibly difficult, incredibly upsetting experiences of revenge pornography, of slut shaming, of sexual assault, against the backdrop of a world that tells them, you've never had it so good, women are equal now, girls don't have any problems anymore, this is a thing of the past.
Now, The Burning is a YA book, but do you think parents should actually be reading it too?
I hope so. One of the things that made me very happy on publication was hearing from a number of parents who've read it alongside their teenage children. And I think for me, that was wonderful, because that was very much part of what I wanted the book to do, to spark conversations and to give a way in, because I know that some parents can find these things really difficult to talk about, and reading a book and having a kind of fictional story to ease the conversation in, if you like, can be a really good way into it. So I really hope that it will be useful and eye-opening for educators and for parents, as well as for teenagers themselves.
Absolutely. Now, Laura's session on motherhood is taking place on the 28th of May. If you're listening to this programme after that date, you can log on to the Hey Player and hear it all again. Laura, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I'd like to turn to award-winning writer and journalist Matthew D'Ancona. Matt's a former columnist and deputy editor of the Sunday Telegraph, the former editor of The Spectator, and now editor and partner at Tortoise Media. His new book is Identity, Ignorance, Innovation: Why the Old Politics is Useless and What to Do About It. It's a powerful polemic against the rising tide of right-wing populism and divisive politics. It's a call to arms, inviting readers to think afresh, to seek new ways of challenging political extremism, bombastic populism, and democratic torpor on both left and right. Matt argues that we need to understand the world in a new way, with a framework built from the three I's: identity, ignorance, and innovation. The I's in the title of his book. Matt, thanks so much for joining us. And I wonder if you could start by talking us through the journey of identity politics through COVID.
Yes, well, it's been a very interesting one because, of course, COVID has sharpened and revealed the differences between different groups, notably ethnic groups. COVID has been much tougher on people of colour for a variety of reasons, socioeconomic and otherwise. But beyond that, there was the extraordinary horror of George Floyd's murder in May 2020, which happened in a way that was very, very horrific, but also very unusual, which was that the world was sort of in an immobilized state because of lockdowns and so on. And everyone saw this absolutely appalling footage and watched a man die on iPhone footage. And that really, I think, energized a sense of social and racial injustice and led to a whole series of protests, not just in America, but around the world, which were very much rooted in the new identity politics that had, even before the pandemic, been the subject of a great deal of controversy. And I set myself in the book to look at identity politics both before and after COVID. In fact, I'd started the book before the pandemic struck, and I was fascinated by and intrigued by identity politics in equal measure, but it was sharpened by the very extreme circumstances of COVID.
What's the ignorance for in the title?
Well, the ignorance is really about the pressures that young people are under today, really due to the law of unintended consequences, because several decades ago, the world moved towards standardized testing in good faith in order to encourage educational rigor and fairness and so on in the classroom and indeed in universities. But over the years, this has encouraged a kind of manic teaching to the test and a prevalence of cramming and the reduction of educational institutions into exam factories, which has, I think, become bad for education. And that has converged with the impact of technological transformation. And I talk about the idea of the digital instant, that people are now trapped in a kind of digital nanosecond where they're being constantly bombarded by messages and notes and takes and emails and social media notifications to the extent it's very difficult for them to think in longer term of themselves as citizens of a stretch of time as well as a place. And this is especially hard for young people. And so the ignorance section is about how I think the younger generation are brilliant and exciting and have a lot of really genuinely transformative political and social ideas. But they have been given a raw deal when it comes to the imparting of knowledge and wisdom. And I think it's incumbent on older generations to help them out of that, because the ignorance I'm talking about is not a moral failure on their part. It's a moral failure on the part of older generations who haven't really given them what they deserve. And I think that this is now reaching a point of crisis where you have kids who know, who are able to do intellectually astonishing things, but have almost no hinterland at all because they have been force-fed as examinees, as candidates for exams, and obviously are the first generation really to operate entirely in the digital world. And we need to step up to that challenge.
And innovation?
Well, innovation is really about specifically about the resilience you need to deal with a world in which change is constant. Change is, of course, nothing new. I mean, every decade has its transformative technology going back millennia, really. But what's going on now is a much more pulverizing process. And if you look at the whole series of forces that are going to come to bear on, again, on the young as they grow up, they'll be living routinely to 100. They'll be facing the problems of climate change. They'll be facing the threat to full employment of technology and needing to retrain for several careers in the course of a life. They'll be dealing, no doubt, with future epidemics, which may become pandemics if we don't build up resilience against that. And so the innovation section of the book is really about how societies have to think differently to deal with the new and update their structures and their systems so that they are more, to use Taleb's phrase, anti-fragile.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at technology and globalization, I mean, obviously these can undermine stable communities, but can they also be a force for good? And I'm thinking here of the example of the Digital Hay Festival, where there are new books presented, big topics discussed, ideas debated in a very balanced and open-minded way.
I think it's quite clear that the web is, like all technologies, value neutral in the sense that it is what we put into it. And during the pandemic, I think it's been on balance a force for good, because although it's been a source of disinformation and misinformation, it's also been a wonderful way of people staying in touch in every conceivable fashion, not only just in basic things like medical information and vaccine notifications and so on, but as you say, as a force to enable culture to carry on. And Hay has been magnificent in that respect, that one thinks of the Hay Festival so much as a physical event, a yearly pilgrimage, if you like, where we all go to see the best writers in the world and our friends, and I've taken my children, and it's just such a wonderful ritual. And it's been, I think, incredibly impressive the way the organizers have shifted to the digital sphere and maintained the spirit and the ethos of Hay, and of course, open it up to ever more people who wouldn't necessarily have been able to travel to the site. So moving out of the pandemic and thinking of next year, I hope that, you know, there'll be a kind of hybrid hay where you get the best of both worlds.
Mm, absolutely. Now, one thing you address in your book is reading for pleasure and why it's important. I guess that goes back to what you were saying about youngsters not having a hinterland.
Yes, very much so. I think that people have forgotten, they treat books rather like DIY tools, things that you use for certain specific purposes. And of course, that's often true. But what has been lost a little, I think, is just the idea that reading is part of our, if you like, our cultural nutrition, that we can read it and just enjoy great classics, and not just the classics of Western literature, by the way. I mean, one of the most important things in all of this is that, yes, there should be a literary canon, a list of books that we all read, but it shouldn't just be by the great Western writers. We should be looking at incredible writers from the African-American tradition, from the African tradition, from the East. And I think this is happening already, but there is less time at the moment, or less time set aside for people to do this. And I think that's a very sad development of reflection. My experience with young people journalistically has been that if you offer them classic writings, they are absolute, you know, their appetite for it is insatiable. They just need to be given the opportunity.
Mm, absolutely. Now, you're doing a session at Hay called Hanging in the Balance, A New Global Order. Tell me about that.
I think it's going to be really interesting because we've got Lord Peter Ricketts, who's written a terrific book about what Britain does next, called Hard Choices, and Lisa Nandy, who is Shadow Foreign Secretary. And I in fact, was followed along with the other leadership candidates during the Labour leadership race. And although Keir Starmer won the race and was always going to win the race, I think Lisa Nandy was, by common consent, the standout performer actually on the hustings. She was quite something. And she's definitely a rising star in the British political world. Very, very charismatic. She's already growing in this new brief, serious contender to be, I think, anything really. I mean, there are no heights beyond her. And so along with Peter, who's an amazing figure of British public life, and Lisa, who's one of its rising stars, I'm really excited about the session.
And it takes place on Tuesday, the 1st of June, and that's at 4 p.m.
That's right. That's when we'll be there.
Matt, thank you very much indeed. That's Matthew D'Ancona. His book, Identity, Ignorance, Innovation, Why the Old Politics is Useless and What to Do About It, is published by Hodder. And you can find out more and book for the digital sessions online at hayfestival.com. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, produced by Nora Hull, edited by Maylie Evans, and presented by me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.